We're holding on page 52 in Bava Metzia, beginning of Ois Chaf, but beginning Perek Ezo Neshech. The subject of Perek Ezo Neshech is all about Ribis. So you have the Mishnah starts by distinguishing between Ribis Daraisa and Ribis Darabanan. Ribis Daraisa is what we usually think of as Ribis. Reuven is lending Shimon $100, Shimon is supposed to pay back $110, or something like that. Ribis Darabanan is a variety of other cases. The Gemara later on in the Perek categorizes and gives a summary. In the halacha part, it's not here in Ein Yaakov, that the basic idea is what's called agar neter. If you're giving somebody a reward for the fact that he's waiting for payment from you, then that's a form of ribis d'rabanan. So you have different kinds of cases involving all kinds of dinim involving prepayments, involving making deals about things that are going to be sold later and locking in a price now, and so on and so forth. The whole pair of deals with all kinds of ins and outs of those things. So the Gemara discusses. So the Gemara starts discussing. We have a lot of different mitzvahs throughout the Torah in different aspects of dinim mominus, of not taking money that belongs to somebody else. Among them is the dinim about ribis, and then you also have the mitzvah of not stealing, and the mitzvah of not withholding somebody's wages, and so on and so forth. So the Gemara deals with why we need all of those. Why couldn't it have said some of them, and we could have derived others from them. So in the course of the discussion, the Gemara says, Lo tignovu because of Rahmana, lama li. Why does the Torah need to tell us specifically, do not steal? Once the Torah has told us that you're not allowed to take ribis, and you're not allowed to do oinah, then automatically that means if you can't even do those, alachas kama v'kama, you can't outright steal from another person. Rashi points out, the question is not on lo tignov from the Aseret HaDibros, because the Gemara tells us elsewhere, Rashi mentions it on the pasuk, that refers to kidnapping. So, of course, that needs to be said, but the question is, why do we need a separate mitzvah not to steal when we should be able to logically derive it from the fact that we're not allowed to do ribis and oinah? And the answer is, look at the Tanya. We need it for what it says in a braisa. Lo tignovu, that means even amanas lemikat. Even if a person is stealing only in order to cause tsar to the other person. So he has no intention of keeping it for himself. He just wants to harass the other guy and make him feel tsar for a while. You're still not allowed to do that. There's a well-known story in that connection with a guy the Baal Shem Tov meets up with on the road and whispers in his ear, and all the Baal Shem Tov's Talmidim think that he must be one of the tzaddikim nistarim. To make a long story short, what happened was that years earlier, this guy had done just that to his best friend. The guy was careless and left money around the house. So this fellow now that the Baal Shem Tov met on the road figured he'll take the money and then keep it for a while so that the guy will start getting nervous about where is it, and then he'll tell them, I have it with you, be careful, don't just leave your money lying around the house in the future. Kitzer amaisa, one thing snowballed into another. He didn't have a chance to return it, not without everybody thinking that he really is a ganav. And years passed, and he hasn't yet figured out what to do about it. And now the Baal Shem Tov whispers in his ear that you got to go, you got to bite the bullet and go do it. Go tell your friend why you did it, and he'll be moichel you. So that would be an example of this love of this almanas l'meikat. So he never intended to take the money in order to keep it. He was just doing it in order to yank the other guy's chain for a little bit. But nevertheless, that's still awesome. Another example, lo tignovu almanas l'shalom tashlomei kevel. Also, don't steal, even when your plan is that then you're going to go deny it in Beis Din, and there'll be edim, and you'll end up paying tashlomei kevel, and you figure that way you have a way. So let's say, for example, Rashi explains, you want to give the guy money, you know he's too proud to accept it, so you're going to do this whole play act in order that way he'll get it in what he thinks is a legitimate way. Nevertheless, you're still not allowed to do that. Here's another one. Lav dekosev rachmana b'mishkolis lomali. What about, there's another lav in the Torah involving dinim mominus that you're not allowed to have false weights and measures. So weights in particular. So why do we need that? Again, if the Torah is already telling us that you're not allowed to steal, and the Torah is telling us you're not allowed to cheat somebody and then defraud him in business, then why do we need that? We should be able to learn it from that. So I said, Avashi answers, L'toymen mishkoloise v'melach. It comes to teach us about a person who takes his weights and buries them in salt. You have weights, you have stone or whatever, or metal or whatever kind of weights they're made out of. The Gemara in Bava Basra deals in some detail with what are the valid materials to make weights out of so that they don't lose weight or gain weight over time. So now a person takes them and buries them in salt. So Rashi explains, what does that accomplish? That makes them heavier, but that's just because the salt causes them to absorb moisture from the air. So now we're talking about, in other words, a buyer. And, you know, nowadays, let's say you go to the store, and you go to the store and they weigh you out from behind the counter a pound of something, then they use their own scales and that's that, and you trust that their scale is accurate. In the old days, sometimes what would happen is you want to buy X amount of meat or whatever it is, you would bring along your own weights and put them on the scale in order to and have the storekeeper weigh with those. So now you might conceivably take your weight, which for example, which is supposed to be a 1 pound weight, and bury it in salt. Now it weighs 1.1 pounds, and then you're going to end up getting extra. Then you're going to end up getting extra with it.
Storekeeper cannot.
He may not realize. You see. He could, of course, but not necessarily. Is he going to do for every single customer? He may not bother. That's how Rashi learns. Tosfos and the Gemara also mentions this point in Bava Basra, and Tosfos and the Rashbam there say the other way around, that the salt is, it eats away at the weight and makes it weigh less. So in that case, we're talking about the storekeeper's weights, that he would bury them in salt, so that same idea in reverse, a weight that's supposed to be 1 pound only weighs actually now 0.9 of a pound, and then that way he can take advantage of the customer. So then when I ask, hi, Gezel Malyahu, wait a minute, that's full-fledged Gezel, why do we need a separate pasuk for that? And the answer is lava olam, mishas asiya, already as soon as he puts them in salt, even if he doesn't actually use them, then already he's over on this issue of loisasu ofo b'mishpat. So the Gemara expands on that point. Tanan Abanan, when the pasuk says loisasu ofo b'mishpat, don't do injustice, unfairness in mishpat, in judgment, b'mida in measurements, b'mishkol in weight, or b'mesura, and in the simple meaning of mesura is liquid measure. But the Gemara is going to explain soon that it's actually the name of a specific liquid measure. So, b'mishpat k'mashmoy. B'mishpat means exactly what it sounds like, to not be unfair in judgment. This is in parenthesis, actually, and the Gemara doesn't have it. And Rashi, in fact, on the pasuk says b'mishpat over there does not refer to cases in Beis Din, because there you have different psukim for that. You have earlier in Parshas Kedoshim, loisasu ofo b'mishpat, which refers to that the dayonim and everybody else who's involved in the din Torah shouldn't do anything underhanded. No, b'mishpat over here means the mishpat of mida mishkal mesura. When a person is weighing or measuring or what have you, it's like a mini mishpat, it's like a mini judgment, and therefore he has to be completely honest about it. So, b'midah z'umadidas karka. When it says measuring, that refers, for example, to measuring out land. So, for example, don't measure for one person. Let's say you have a yoshim, are splitting up a property, or people have a property and they decide to divide it up between themselves or whatever. Don't measure for one in the summer and the other in the winter. Rashi explains that they would use ropes in those days for measuring. The rope will expand and shrink depending on the temperature and depending on how wet or dry it is. So if you measure at one time in one season and in a different season with the same rope, it's going to come out slightly different. And as the Gemara points out, the Gemara mentions later on in the Masechta that one of the Chachamim was a professional surveyor. One of the Chachamim, one of the Amoraim, I think Rava, tells him that based on this, you have to be very, very careful with your measurement. Even the tiniest little amount of ground, you have to consider, conceivably the owner could plant karkoim, which is saffron in there, which is a very, very expensive spice. So you have even a tiny little piece of land, a square inch or less even, could make a difference. The person could grow calcum over there and make a lot of money, so therefore you have to be careful down to the nth degree as far as you're measuring. The Rambam mentions in this connection, first of all, that it means also that not just you can't use the same rope in different seasons, like we're saying over here. It means also, for example, the surveyor has to know geometry. He has to know part of the mathematics of surveying to be able to make his calculations accurately. And in addition, the Rambam also mentions if he's using ropes, then yeah, you can't use them in different seasons. If, let's say, for example, it's also common in some places to use metal chains for surveying, then there's no problem. Those don't shrink and expand with the different seasons. So then, gizunta hey, if you want to measure in different seasons, then go ahead. Okay, so that's b'mida. So be careful with that. And the point is, now the surveyor himself doesn't stand to gain from measuring more to one and less to the other. He's doing a job. He's getting paid for his job regardless. Nevertheless, he has to know to be careful not to even do something that would be a little bit dishonest or a little bit inaccurate that ends up being in favor of one or the other of them. Next, b'mishko, what does it mean in measure? It means in weight. Shelo yafnin mishkalos b'melach. What we just said, that he shouldn't bury his weights in salt, which makes them more, which makes them more or less heavy, as the case may be. Uvamasura, obviously, Rashi and Tosfos and the Rashbam don't necessarily have to be arguing on the Metzios. It may well depend on, may well depend on the local climate and on the material that the weights are made from and various other factors. Anyway, Uva Mesura, what does it mean that you have to be honest? In Mesura means Shelo Yartiach. When you're pouring, when you're pouring liquid into a customer's container, don't let it foam up. Because then, you know, the foam goes down. Think of like when you pour a cup of soda and you have a huge head of foam over there, and then it disappears and the cup is three quarters empty. So there, so don't do that. Now, if it was three quarters empty, the customer is going to notice. But in other words, the point is, even if it's a tiny amount less, then you can't do that. And we can make a kavachomer in this connection. Now, the simple meaning of mesura is just a, it means liquid measure in general. But mesura is a is also the name of a specific measure, which is, as the Gemara is going to say over here, a tiny fraction of a lug. So umam mesura shehi echad mishloishim ushloisha over shisha belug mandacha mesura, which is 1/33 or 1/36 of a lug, hikpida all of Torah, and the Torah is makpid to not allow it to foam up when you're pouring into a mesura. So we have to consider a lug is somewhere is a lug is somewhere around a pint, give or take, because you have a revius is about 3 or 4 ounces depending on the different poskim, and a lug is four times that. So a lug is somewhere between about 12 and 16 ounces lefi arach. 1/33rd or 1/36th of that would be like a third of an ounce or so, like a half ounce or a half an ounce or a third of an ounce. So you're talking smaller even than a kelishful. And yet we're saying that when you're pouring into such a container, be careful not to let it foam up. Now, if it foams up, sahakal, how much is the customer losing already? We're not talking about you, that you're going to have that three quarters of it is going to be foam. You're talking about a tiny little bit on the top would be foam like that. And yet the Torah is makbid not to do that. Kavachomer, lachat lahin, how much more so if you're measuring out in a hin measure of liquid, lachat sihin, or a half a hin, or shlisha sahin, or a revias sahin, or a third or a quarter of a hin, the lug, lachat si lug, or a revias halug, how much more you have to be careful not to allow it to foam up. So that is what the Torah is telling us by the words loisasu over bamishvat, bamida bamishkol of amasura. That in all these areas of weighing and measuring and everything, you have to be careful to the nth degree to not allow there to be the tiniest little bit of inaccuracy. In Baba Basra, the Gemara goes into many details about these things, how exactly scales are supposed to be constructed so they're 100% accurate, how you have when you measure out grain or things like that, how to level it off so it's 100% accurate, and so on and so forth. A whole bunch of dinim over there.
There's something about when the customer is like automatically giving up.
Mevater?
Yeah.
So you, I mean, you can have, if the customer says, you know, I don't care if you foam it up for me a little bit, then fine, you know. Okay.
So the porter, whatever it is.
Yeah, maybe. And if he's mevata, he's mevata. But you're not allowed to do that. Okay. You have to be careful to be as accurate as possible. Yeah, by the way, you know, the Mishnah in Beitza tells us, and the Gemara there expands on it, that there were Chachamim who were storekeepers in Yerushalayim in the years before the Churban. Avashol ben Botnis, and I forgot who the other one was, the father of Reb Tzadik, I think. Anyway, there were storekeepers in Yerushalayim. They sold wine and oil, and the usual thing was a person would come and buy wine or oil. They would bring their own container, and the storekeeper would pour the wine or the oil into the customer's container, and then he'd take it home. So the Mishnah describes over there, and then the Gemara explains that now when you pour, some of the wine or some of the oil sticks to the container that you're pouring from. So even they would leave it suspended there all night to get as much as possible out, but inevitably some would still stay stuck. So over time, it added up. Over time, they carefully scraped off those little bits from the containers. Eventually, it amounted to hundreds of barrels over the years that they were in business, and all the tens of thousands of, or hundreds of thousands of customers that they served, and they didn't even want to have hanah from that. The Gemara tells over there, they brought it to the Gizbarim of the Bais Mikdash and said, we want to give it to Hekdesh because it's not ours. And the Gizbarim told them, you're not required to. And they said, nevertheless, we don't even want a trace of Gezel in our hands. So yeah. The Gemara continues. Amar Rama, Lomali de Kosser Rachmana Yitzias Mitzrayim Beribis, Yitzias Mitzrayim Gabitzitzis, Yitzias Mitzrayim Bamishkolis. Why is it by all these three dinim The Pasuk mentions, Hashem says, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, who took you out of Eretz Mitzrayim. Why dafka by those three things? In other words, Yun Yaakov points out the question is not so much that you could say it's that Hashem is saying, I took you out of Mitzrayim so that you'll accept my mitzvahs. But then fine, I could just say, Asher Ushmauta Mitzvot, Asher Tzeis Yeschem Eretz Mitzrayim, Ani Hashem. So why dafka by these three does it specifically mention the point that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim? So like this. So the Hashem is saying by these three things. At first, Anihu Shevchanti b'Mitzrayim ben Tipa Shabachor l'Tipa She'ena Shabachor. I'm the one who in Mitzrayim was able to distinguish between the drop that of Zerah that produced the Bachor and the one that did not. Because Rashi mentions on the Pasuk the Mitzri women were promiscuous, so often you'd have one woman had been with 10 men and she has 10 sons, each one from a different man, and nobody knows. Her husband thinks that they're all his kids, and now by Makas Bachor the Eibishter knows who is who, and the ones who are the actual Bechorim are the ones who are killed. So Hashem says, Ani hu she'asad li parah mimisha tola ma'osa ba'orit gechavim ma'al va'osa li'Yisrael b'ribis. First of all, then Hashem says, I will be the one to pay back, to punish somebody who attributes his money to a goy and lends them to another yid at ribis. Meaning, he knows, and everybody knows, that one yid is not allowed to lend to another at ribis. So what does he do? He claims that this money is not my money, this is money that I'm managing on behalf of a goy. And therefore, I'm allowed to lend it to this, and he goes and does that. So now Hashem says, I know the truth, and I'm gonna punish such a person who does that.
Is it allowed?
Tosfos actually discusses, it's not here in Ein Yaakov, but Tosfos on the Gemara discusses, would that even be allowed anyway, even if it genuinely was the case that he's managing a goy's money, is he in fact allowed to lend it at ribis? So in certain cases, there are haterim for it. This is somewhat negaya nowadays. Imagine, for example, a yid works for Bank of America or Chase or what have you. Is he allowed to arrange a mortgage or a bank loan or whatever for a Yiddish customer? Without a heter iska, it's not so simple. I mean, there you could say he has no reshus over the money at all, as opposed to here you could argue that he has, maybe the goy gives him a free hand in deciding what to do with it. But yeah, it's
also a commission out of
that. Yeah, so it's not so simple. Yeah. In Israel, Taka, where the banks are mostly Jewish owned, then Taka, all the banks have to have a heter iska in order for you to be able to do any kind of business with them. So that's one. And the second one, Misha Toman Mishkalosu Melach, somebody who buries his weight in salt, like we were just discussing. So him also, Hashem says that I'll punish him the same way as I was able to tell which people are Bechorim and which are not. Or Misha Tola Kola Ilan Bevigdoi. And the third one, somebody who puts Kola Ilan, which is indigo, which resembles tchelas, on his clothing, and he claims that it's tchelas. Now, real tchelas is extremely expensive, because Rashi brings from the Gemara in Menachos. We know that the tchelas came from the chilozen, and it comes out of the sea only once every 70 years. By Arya Kaplan, Rosh Hashanah mentions in his commentary, The Living Torah, he says that somebody once did some research on it and found, assuming that the particular snail that they think might have been the one that was used for tchelas, it takes like 8,000 of them to make like 1 cubic centimeter of tchelas dye. So it would be, especially since they're so rare to find, it would be enormously expensive. So now a person might think to get away with the cheaper stuff, with kola ilan, and the Eidosha says, I'll know the truth. What do these three things have in common? So Marasha says that all these things are, a person thinks that he has a chance to dishonestly earn some extra money. He's going to pretend that the money is a goy's and lend it out at ribis when really it's his own money. He's going to make his weights heavier or lighter, as the case may be, and get a little extra when he buys or sells. And with the kola ilan, he figures that he's going to use cheap kola ilan and act as though and sell it as though it's expensive tchelas. So now the vote is, Marsha explains, well, what does it have to do with Mitzrayim? The Mitzrayim tried to do the same kind of thing. They enslaved the Jewish people in order to increase their nechosim. They figured, we'll have Pisan and Ramses, we'll have big storage cities and all kinds of other big public buildings on the backs of the Jews. So and they're there, that's why Hashem punished their Bechorim. So, and it had to do also, he explains, what would happen they would, so now, what would actually happen when you have these 10 Mitzri boys, each of whom is truly a Bechor of his father, but they don't know that, eventually they would actually be in line to get, eventually when the truth comes out, they would be in line to get a double portion from their respective father's inheritance, because each of them is a Bechor of his father. Now the Eibishter kills them and prevents them from doing that. So therefore it's the same thing. These people think that they're going to gain money in these illegal ways, and Hashem says, I know the truth, and it's not going to happen. The one about Kola Ilan and Tcheles, actually, there's an enormous amount of discussion. Tosfos over here says very briefly that, isn't he anyway over on the mitzvah of tzitzis? But the chiddush is that even as soon as he puts the Kola Ilan on the clothing, then he's already over. There was an enormous amount of discussion about that among Rishonim and Achronim, because the question is, what's the big deal? So a person wants to, back when they had Tcheles, and a person is going to take Kola Ilan and use it instead of Tcheles. Why are we putting it in the same category as other things where he's trying to cheat other people? What is he trying to do, Sahakol? He's fooling himself. He's putting Kola Ilan on his clothing instead of Tcheles. Or even you could argue that he's putting some of the threads Kola Ilan and then some genuine Tcheles. What's the big deal? So there's quite a lot of Mefarshim who explain that the problem is over here more when he sells it as such. For him himself to wear Kola Ilan might not be such a big deal. But for him to go and sell it to others and claim that it's Tcheles and prevent them from doing the mitzvah properly, that's where the problem is, and that's where the Eibishter is saying he's going to punish him. That said, there are Mefoshim who explain that it means even he himself does it, as Tosfos says, he's over on it already from when he puts it on the garment, because he has intent to trick other people with it, even if he's not going to sell it. This gets into the discussion about Tcheles nowadays. We know 150 or so years ago that Abzinner Rebbe said that he had rediscovered Tcheles, and ever since then you have a few other people who've claimed to have discovered different creatures from which Tcheles comes. You have like nowadays three or four different kinds of creatures from which different groups produce Tcheles. But one of the big questions is, if in fact it's not the genuine one, then is a person over on this stuff? The Gemara is saying over here that he's putting Kola Ilan, fake Tcheles, instead of the real thing. Or is that tackle only a problem? Maybe only if he means to defraud, whereas these people genuinely, each group holds that theirs is the genuine Tcheles, or they're not doing it to sell, and we're saying that some Rishonim learn that the problem is only if he's selling. So there's quite a lot of ink has been spilled on this whole issue. Lemaisa, for example, when the Radziner Rebbe wrote to the Rebbe Rashab about his Tcheles, the Rebbe Rashab replied with a long letter pointing out, among other things, even if we say that your identification is valid, the Arizal tells us we're not going to have Tcheles, it's going to remain hidden until Mashiach comes, and therefore nothing doing. So the Maisa, most Lubavitchers and most Jews in the wider world don't wear it, but you have various groups of Hasidim and various groups in Eretz Yisrael and so forth who wear one or another of the types of Tcheles that have been claimed to be rediscovered. There's a Sicha, by the way, where the Rebbe talks about, I think it's Chelik Yudbeis, I don't remember, about this that we're saying, that Yitzias Mitzrayim is mentioned in connection with Mishkolos, and the Gemara elsewhere explains that it means even as soon as he makes, like we said over here, as soon as he puts them in salt, then already he's over. And in other places, the Gemara mentions similarly, as soon as a person makes a false weight and has it in his house, then already he's over, then already he's over on the mitzvah. So what does that have to do with Yitzias Mitzrayim? So there's a Sicha where the Rebbe talks about the deeper idea behind it. What was the problem with the Mitzriim? The Rambam asked the famous question. The Eibishter said, "Ba'avodim ve'inu osam." So why are the Mitzriim held guilty for enslaving the Jewish people? So the Rambam's famous answer is because Hashem didn't say any individual Mitzri should do it. Hashem said collectively they'll do it. So the Rambam said, "Alderach." Like if you say statistically in this population there are going to be some tzaddikim and some rishoyim. That doesn't give each person an excuse to say, "Well, I'll be the Rosha." So the same way, each individual Mitzri has the choice to be the bad guy or not. The Rebbe disagrees very sharply with that and gives a different explanation, but anyway, the Rebbe explains that ties into this. When the person has a measure, has a weight, which by definition measures are supposed to be to weigh and measure accurately. When you have a weight that says on it 1 pound, for example, it looks like for all the world, like you plan to be honest. You have something that weighs a pound, and you're going to take a pound and no more. And now that weight is dishonest, too much or too little, as the case may be. So what it is the person is taking the very concept of weighing and measuring and defrauding with it. So now that's a similar way to the Mitzvim are taking the idea that the Eivishter said, Va'avodim v'inuoisam, and each individual Mitzvi deciding on his own, I'm going to be one of those ones who va'avodim v'inuoisam. And therefore, that's the connection between them, and that's why the Eivishter is saying that he knows the truth and he's going to punish people who do such things. The Gemara continues, Ravina ikla l'sura dipros. Ravina one time visited the city of Sura de Pros. Now you have the regular Sura, which is mentioned throughout Shas, where it was Rav had his yeshiva, and later the yeshiva there lasted for hundreds of years. It was still running strong in the time of the Goyim. But now this is a different city of the same name, located on the Pros River. Anyway, Amalei Rav Chanina mi Sura de Pros Ravina. So Rav Chanina from Sura de Pros, one of the local Chachamim, asks Ravina. Here's another mitzvah where it says Yitzias Mitzrayim by it. So why? Yitzias Mitzrayim, because of Rachman Agabe Shrotzim Lomali. Why does it mention Yitzias Mitzrayim in connection with Shrotzim? At the end of Parashat Shemini, when it talks about not eating Shrotzim, then the Pasuk says, Ki ani Hashem hamala eschem me'eretz Mitzrayim. So what does one have to do with the other? All the ones we said so far, like Marashah says, all of them involve a person that's trying to gain money illegally, and like the Mitzvim, who were doing with enslaving the Jewish people, so therefore they were just saying, I'll punish such a person. What is Shrotzim? What is eating Shrotzim or not eating Shrotzim have to do with that? Omalei, so Ravina says, because Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, similar idea. I'm the one who knew to distinguish between a drop of a Bechor and a drop of Zera that did not produce a Bechor. I will punish somebody who mixes the kitchkis, or the eggs, of tomei fish, which are a form of shrotin, with the entrails or eggs of kosher fish, or moshkan lisrael, and sells them to Jews. In other words, imagine, for example, let's say you have caviar. Good quality caviar comes from non-kosher fish. But you have mastama cheaper kinds that also do. So now, for example, you have a person might take fish eggs from kosher fish, which are more expensive, mix in some non-kosher ones in order to bulk it up, and sell it, and pretend that it's all from kosher fish. So it's in the same way. In other words, he's causing people to eat shrotzim, and therefore the Eivishter is saying, I'm going to punish him in the same way as I punished the Mitzrim. Omalei, so again, kirvei dogim could mean the eggs, it could mean the kishkis themselves that are used for like fish fat and different things like that. They used to have in those times we find in the Gemara in a number of places that a popular dip that was made out of fish guts. So whatever the case, the point is that a person might take non-kosher ones and mix them in order to bulk it up and sell it and then sell it at the price of kosher ones. Omalei, so the Chanina Misura says, you're misunderstanding my question. Anoha malek kakashali. My question is not really so much why it says Mitzrayim. I can understand, fine, there's your drosha. But why specifically does it say hamale? This is the only place, in all the other places, Asher Hetzes Yes Chameretz Mitzrayim, or other similar Lashonis. Why over here is it hamale es Chameretz Mitzrayim that I brought you up from the land of Mitzrayim? So why? So Ravina answers him, look at the Tana Dvei Rabbi Shmuel. It comes to teach us what Tana Dvei Rabbi Shmuel said. The Tana Dvei Rabbi Shmuel, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem is saying, If the only reason I had ever brought the Jewish people out of Eretz Mitzrayim was only to accomplish this, She'enin Mitamin B'Shrotzim, that they will not make themselves Tomei by eating Shrotzim, Dai, then that would be enough. So that's Hamala, Hashem is saying that I brought the Jewish people to a higher level, this that they don't eat shrotzim. What are you telling me? There's a greater schar from the Eivishter for avoiding eating shrotzim than there is for the other three, where a person has much more of a taiva for them? Amalei, so Ravina answers him, No, not necessarily is the reward for refraining from shrotzim greater, but they're very disgusting to eat. And therefore the Eivishter is, so to speak, congratulating himself. I took the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim and brought them to a level where they don't have a taiva, for such disgusting low-down, food. In other words, the Gemara actually mentions in some other places that the fact that Goyim eat shrotzim and Jews do not actually makes a difference in the body chemistry of a Jew versus a Goy. The Gemara mentions it in a different place that Goyim have sometimes, at least maybe in those times, I don't know, but in any case, a higher natural body temperature than Jews do, because they eat shrotzim, and some of those are like more difficult to digest or whatever it is exactly. So we see that they eat shrotzim, and they develop a certain nature related to those shrotzim, and the Eibishter is saying, Hamala, that I brought the Jewish people up from that level where they don't do that. And that alone made all of Yetzias Mitzrayim worthwhile.
Another place it seems that if they are refraining from eating shrotzim that eats moles, and they're getting such a reward, so...
How much more so other things that are much bigger tiger, that's true, right? One of the explanations on what Ravina means by this is, in other words, that now the result is a yid has a greater natural refinement, not just of his neshama, but of his body, that his body is not naturally primed to want shrotzim. Obviously, you know, a person grows up without any knowledge of Yiddishkeit, and he's in a society where they eat them, then he's not going to know better, but at least once a yid knows something about Yiddishkeit, then he naturally has a certain revulsion to these things. There's a sicha actually where the Rebbe talks about a point of it also. Shrotzim, the definition of shrotzim is creatures that either have no legs or have very short legs, so that when they move around on the ground, they look like they're just sort of slithering along. So it includes things like snakes and worms and whatnot, and it includes various creatures, various kinds of insects, and then reptiles and whatnot that have short legs. So that means, in other words, they have a very close connection to the ground. So now the Eibishter is saying, I brought the Jewish people to a level where they don't have a connection with such creatures that are on the ground and are like the next thing up from the ground. But rather, they're on a higher level than that. And the Rebbe explains, this is a Rashi sicha. Rashi brings this Gemara over here at the end of Parashat Shmini. On that pasuk, Rashi does not usually quote the Baal HaMaimer, whoever said a particular thing. Rashi usually doesn't quote the name of the Tana or Amora who says it, but here he does, and the Rebbe connects it with, there's a Mishnah in Masechet Negoyim where Rabbi Shmuel says about the Jewish people in connection with Saras that their coloration is nothing like, is not dark. Jews are not, most Jews, your average Jew, is not natural. Really dark skin. They're not pale either like a German, but there's something in between, and that represents, in other words, also this point that we have less to do with the ground, as in you have the shrotzim that slither on the ground, on the dark colored ground, and we're removed from that kind of thing. So that's that. If it said Hitzesi, it just means I took them out of Mitzrayim, like every other thing. Hamala means Hashem is saying I elevated the Jewish people to a higher level by taking them out of Mitzrayim. No, but that's the point. Hamala here was saying, by Shrotzim specifically, there's Hamala that Hashem brought us to a higher level.
That includes
Hotzeisi. It includes Hotzeisi, yeah. As far as, by the way, the Tchelas and the Kola Ilan, Anaf Yosef brings here an interesting point. Tackle what is so bad about a person using Kola Ilan instead of Tchelas. I mean, they look basically the same in color, so what's the problem? So he says like this. The Gemara tells, there's two major reasons why the Eibishter gave us the mitzvah of Tchelas. One is, the Gemara tells us in Menachos and a couple of other places, Tchelas resembles the sea, and the sea resembles the Rakia, and the Rakia resembles the Kisei HaKavod, and so forth, and then when a person looks at the Tchelas, then it puts him in mind of the Eibishter. The other reason Rashi mentions on the Pasuk is that Tchelas is related to an Aramaic word that means a person losing their children, Rahman al-Islam, which therefore reminds us of Makas Bechoris. So now, if a person uses Kola Ilan, fine, he may still have the first thing, but he's missing out the second thing. He's missing out the remembrance of Makas Bechoris and the gratitude to the Eibishter for that. And for that, we're saying, Hashem is saying, well, you want to pretend like your Kola Ilan is equivalent to Tchelas, means you're missing the whole point about remembering Makas Bechoris, and therefore, the same Eibishter who brought about Makas Bechoris and punished the Mitzvim is also going to deal with such a person as well.
Guarantee that. The person's going to the whole shtarfus.
It's not a guarantee. It's not a guarantee, of course. Nothing is a guarantee. Okay, it's not a guarantee, but ha'odam nifo kafi po'uloisav, as the Sefer HaChinuch says many times, a person is affected by the actions that he does. So he wears tchelas on a day-to-day basis, and at some point he's bound to think to himself, you know what, this resembles the yam, and so forth, and that starts a train of thought by him, which makes him think of the Eibishter. That's the Sefer HaChinuch writes this, for example, in connection with the mitzvahs of Pesach. He says that, you know, you have all the mitzvahs to commemorate Yetzias Mitzrayim. Why do we need so many? And he explains, because Hodam Nifok Afi Pa'ulosav, the more Pa'ulos the person does with a certain end in mind, the more he's likely to think of what the Eibishter wants him to think about as a result of it. Yeah. Okay. Again, keep in mind, by the way, we were saying before, Tchelus is quite expensive also. So when a person is spending that large amount of money on Tchelus, then it's more likely to put him in a frame of mind to think, what is this representing? Maybe she didn't just tell me to put Tchelus, to spend X number of dollars on Tchelus for my clothing for nothing. So that starts train of thought in his mind. Yeah. Okay. Pista, quoting from the Mishnah. So the Mishnah had said, now like this, in a lot of the places where the Torah talks about ribis, it uses two words, neshech and tarbis, or marbis. So the Gemara explains that even though on a Daraisa level, those may actually mean two different things, Dirabbanan, they're basically considered the same thing. However, the Mishnah explains, so the Mishnah says, Ezehu Neshech, what is an example of Neshech, is with things that are Ribis Daraisa, and then what is Tarbis is things that are Ribis Dirabbanan. So the Mishnah says, Ezehu Tarbis, Hamarbe Peres Chula, for example, a person is going to arrange whether the other person is going to get more produce for money that he's prepaying now. The Mishnah describes a scenario where one of the many scenarios of Ribis Dirabbanan is where you're making a contract now about produce to be delivered later, and you're locking in a price now, and now you have what we said before is called agonetter. The other you're giving the other person something extra for the fact that he's waiting to get his payment or to get his merchandise, and there are issues of Ribis involved over there. So when we say Ezer Tavis Hamad Beperes V'chola, so the question is Otu Kolhani Damina Nahash Dalav Ribasu. So what? The first part of the Mishnah mentions cases of Ribis Daraisa where Reuven says to Shimon, "I'm lending you 2 saw, and you return me 3 saw, or things like that. Those are Ribis Daraisa. Those are also Tavis. So why are you saying Ezeru Tavis is only the cases that are Dirabbanan? Amar Rav Abahu, so Rav Abahu says, what the Mishnah means is not to say that there are different categories as far as the name Tarvis. Ad kan shol Torah, mikan ve'elach shol divrehem. Means the first part of the Mishnah is describing cases of Ribis min haTorah, where it's arranged at the time of the loan that there is going to be an extra repayment later on. That's Ribis Daraisa. From there on, the case with the fruit, for the case with the produce, for example, it's not the scenario that the Mishnah describes over there. It's not an absolute guarantee that there's going to be more produce delivered than what it's worth now. It may end up, it depends what happens with the prices. So you only have, so that kind of thing is Ribis Dirabbanan. Rava says the same thing. The Mishnah is not saying that the term Tarbis applies to only some of the cases in the Mishnah. It means that the first part of the Mishnah is talking about Ribis Daraisa that was arranged at the time of the loan, and the other ones are talking about Ribis Dirabbanan, things that are arranged which are going to turn out to be Ribis later on as things develop. Another way of looking at it, Ad kan yochin rosh of a tzaddik yobosh. Another way of you can understand it is that up until this point, we can say on it, the rosh prepares and the tzaddik wears it. Meaning, Rashi describes, suppose a person did lend money at Ribis, and then he died, and his sons yarshin him, they're not obligated to return the Ribis. So we can, the actual expression of the pasuk in Iyov is Yochin v'tzadik yobosh. He prepares it without saying who the he is, and the tzadik wears it. So in other words, sometimes it happens that a Rosha amasses a lot of wealth, and then a tzadik ends up getting it. like in the story of Yosef Moshe Shabbos, to take one example, yeah. But here, the Gemara is interjecting the word Rosha to say the father was a Rosha because he lent at Ribis, whether Daraisa or Dirabbanan. But now his children are not obligated to return it. So they, who relative to their father are tzaddikim, they are allowed to wear it. So the Gemara asks, Ad kan betuloi, still you're telling me only up until this point and not? If Ribis Daraisa they're not obligated to return, how much more so Ribis Dirabbanan? So what do you mean up until here, up until the middle of the Mishnah is talking about cases where the children don't have to return it, implying that what, afterwards the cases of Ribis Dirabbanan they do have to return? On the contrary. Ela afilu ad kan yochin rosh of a tzaddik yobosh. What it means is even up to that point, even Ribis Daraisa, the children are still not required to return it. The father dies not having had a chance to have hanah from it. The children are able to have hanah from it, and there's no issue. They're not obligated to return it. We did talk about earlier in the Masechta when we talked about the case of a person who inherited Mois Rabois. He inherited a lot of money and he wants to waste it. So there are Rishonim who have the Girsa Mois Ribis. That still, the children may think to themselves, this is Trefa Gelt. We don't really want it mixed in with our own money, and therefore we want to spend it as fast as possible. But Me'ikar Adin, they're not obligated to do that. They're allowed to keep it and they can dress themselves and then do other things with that. So Tosfos points out the angle in it in halacha. Even if you say there's no shinu reshus when a yashins, nevertheless still when the Torah tells us that a person has it, so the Gemara actually presents in this connection of machloikas whether if a person took ribis, is he required by Beis Din to return it or not? There is an opinion in the Gemara that if he took ribis daraisa, then Beis Din will force him to return it, but if it was ribis d'rabbanan, then not. And then there's a different opinion that neither one, and there's a different one, that a different opinion that neither one is he obligated to return. So even the opinion that says he is obligated to return it, Rav Elazar in the Gemara, is still going to say that's only Ribis Daraisa. So therefore, so on that, we can say, Yochin Rosh of Tzadik Yobosh, he's required to return it, but his children are not.
But if people are not supposed to get it to take it back.
They're not supposed to take it back. That's a different point. We learned in Bava Kama, because otherwise it discourages the person from being willing to do tshuva. Right. But the person himself who took the ribis does have an obligation to try to return it, whereas just his children don't even have that obligation.
He does use a bad mark on him that he does.
Yeah, in Okanama, but nevertheless, that's the end.
So you return the Zayla, so it's...
If you want to do it, let you nishmas their father, then fine, maybe, but yeah. Alright. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugo'ola, Yud Aleph Kislev. There's three places in the Torah where the Eved promises to take the Jewish people out of Golos and Achris Ayamim. Number one is in Nitzavim, V'shav Hashem Elokecha Shruscha V'kibetzcha Mikol Ha'amim, etc. So that's a clear promise that there will be a kibbutz Golos. So that's a demonstration that there will be a Ge'ola. Then you have in Parshas Balak and Bilam's last nevuah over there, the Kum Shevet Yisrael, the Karka Kol Bnei Sheis, that there's going to be a ruler, a leader of the Jewish people who's going to rule over all of humanity. That demonstrates not just there's going to be a Geula, but it's going to be through Mashiach, through a human being with the job of Mashiach. Then the third time is in Parshas Shoftim, where the Torah tells us about the Orei Miklat, and then you have that Kaisha Yalchav Hashem Elokechaz Glocha, then you have to add three more cities, so then you have a mitzvah of Orei Miklat, so that's a third angle on it. Not only is there going to be a Geula, and not only is it going to be through Mashiach, but there are even halachas that depend on it, which as the Rambam writes in the Yadah Chazaka, like Tziva HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Torah, Hashem didn't give a mitzvah for nothing, and therefore that means that there has to come a time when that's going to come true. Miyad Mamash. Okay, continuing on the halachas of washing hands in the morning. So we were talking about the two reasons why you have to, because your hands are dirty in the morning and because of ruach ra. And we were talking about that. Rebbe was talking about that the Gemara had said that the Gemara says that because of that ruach ra, there are various things a person shouldn't touch before he washes negovaster, various body parts or water that other people are going to use for netilas yadayim, and therefore when you yourself are washing negovaster, be careful you don't touch the water inside the keli, because the only way it'll make your hands tahor is by pouring it. So now, the kosher game, the Alter Rebbe continues, all the more so, a person has to be very careful before he washes his hands not to touch any food or drink so as not to make them tameh with the, again, he has the tumah on his hands from having slept. So now he shouldn't be touching any food before he washes. Especially, the Alter Rebbe says, women have to be extra careful to know about this because they prepare most of the food in the house. Hold on. First, the Alter Rebbe goes on to point out there's no issue if a goy. Now, you're going to say, if there's tumah on the hands when you wake up, what about if a goy touches food? That's not a problem, says the Alter Rebbe, because this ruach tumah only wants to rest on a place that's kodesh. So therefore, so in a place, so now you have this Kedusha over there, and Kedusha went away from there. By night, the person's neshama goes up Lamaila. So, and then the Ruach HaTumah is able to go on the body. Now, when the neshama comes back to the body, the Ruach HaTumah goes away from the rest of the body and remains only on the hands. But with a goy, you don't have that issue in the first place, so therefore there's no issue with that. Now, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, for the same reason, if little kids who are not of the age of chinuch touch food, there's not necessarily either an issue. Because when does the nefesh HaKedusha completely come into a person is when a boy is 13 and a girl is 12, bar and bas mitzvah. That is after all why they're first chayiv and mitzvahs in Torah at that point and are subject to punishment. When this nefesh hakdosha begins coming into a person when you start being mechanech them for Torah and mitzvahs, there are various ages for chinuch of different mitzvahs. Now, the Alter Rebbe adds in parenthesis, one chinuch of one particular mitzvah is the mitzvah of milah. To a certain extent, then, nefesh elikis starts coming in at the time of a bris milah. And then, as far as a girl, the Rebbe explains in one place in a letter that by her it's right away when she's born, because girls, of course, don't need a bris milah. Therefore, the Alter Rebbe concludes over here, if somebody is going to be careful that even a baby from 8 days old and older should not touch food without watching negovasa, kodesh yomer loy, such a person deserves to be called kodesh. But me, it's not necessary because until the kid is bar or bas mitzvah.